When we look at the Southern Philippines, it's not a single group. It's a variety of groups.
Islamic State claims responsibility for deadly Philippines church bombing. It's Tuesday, January 29th. This is VOA Asia. Hello, I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. You can find us on Facebook at VOA Asia. Also ahead, Beijing detains a Chinese-Australian writer. The United States and North Korea move closer to a second summit. A Taiwan village gets a paint makeover. We visit a dog museum. The expansion of an e-commerce giant. It's all on today's VOA Asia. Islamic State has claimed responsibility for twin bombing Sunday at a cathedral in the rest of southern Philippines, which has killed at least 20 people and 81 wounded. The government said in a statement it has promised to hunt down the attackers until every killer is brought to justice and put behind bars. The statement said the ruthless perpetrators will be shown no mercy. The first bomb exploded during a mass inside the cathedral in Jolo in the province of Sulu. The second blast happened moments later as government forces responded to the first explosion. Members of the military and civilians are among the dead. Jolo is situated in a mostly Muslim region of the predominantly Catholic Philippines. The blasts come just days after the region held an autonomy referendum, which was overwhelmingly approved. Sulu province voters, however, rejected the autonomy vote, but it still will be part of the new entity. Sulu is home to the Islamist militant group Abu Sayyaf, which has been blamed for a number of deadly bombings. VOA Asia's Ira Melman spoke with Roger Baker, Senior VP of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform, Stratfor. He asked Baker if he thought there was any connection between the results of the autonomy referendum.
I believe the two issues are connected. When you look at the way in which the Philippine government has been working to slowly erode the militancy in the southern Philippines, when they strike a deal with one of the large groups, usually fairly soon after or in the process of striking that deal, one of the smaller offshoots or one of the smaller groups actually carries out activities to try to undermine it. And when we look at the way in which this referendum went, Sulu is a place that voted narrowly against joining the referendum. The Abu Sayyaf group has been active within that part of the southern Philippines, and this may in part be their attempt to undermine the ability of the government to peacefully pull off the follow-up to the referendum.
Could they be successful by what they have done?
It's not clear that they're going to be entirely successful by what they've done. The larger Muslim groups, the MILF, has condemned the activity, condemned this attack. They've worked for quite a long time to try to find some way to gain a greater role and responsibility and authority in the southern Philippines. So I don't think that this is going to completely undermine the referendum and undermine the path towards creating the new BARM. But it does demonstrate that when these things happen, you don't instantly have peace just because you've had a referendum or just because you brought a group in. This is a very long-running conflict, and there are a lot of different opinions and views on how the future should be shaped out in the southern Philippines. If we look at this, I think that one of the things to keep in mind is that when we look at the southern Philippines, it's not a single group. It's a variety of groups, and depending upon which island they're on, which part of Mindanao or which part of the Sulu Archipelago they're on, these are different subgroups, different sub-ethnicities, different affinities, and therefore you don't have a single agreement even when you bring one of the larger groups into the fold.
What do you think will happen now? I hate to ask people to look into their crystal balls, but sometimes we have to do that. With your experiences in reading and knowing about this group and these groups, do you think there will be more attacks, similar attacks?
I think that there's going to be more attacks, but we also note that the government has set up a new task force in the southern Philippines to accelerate its operations against the Abu Sayyaf. So this is a group that is facing a fairly extreme pressure from the government. They are losing some of their ability to gain support and succor from some of the larger Islamist groups and former militant groups in the southern Philippines. I don't think that they're going to entirely disappear. But certainly we're going to see factions of the Abu Sayyaf being hunted down and other factions trying to continue this fight and carry out additional attacks.
Do you think that the government of the Philippines has enough ability, weapons, wherewithal to fight this and to be victorious?
I think in the long run, but look, this is a hundreds-year-old conflict. It's not going to be solved purely by military force. And one thing I think, if you look at the Philippine government, that they've expected and their policy slowly but steadily has evolved, and that is in the southern Philippines, keep breaking the militancy down into smaller and smaller groups. And ultimately, it becomes manageable. It may never be fully resolved. At least if you can fracture the larger groups, if you can bring them into some sort of government arrangement, if they can have some role of power and authority, that's going to co-opt them into actually trying to track down and hunt down some of these smaller militant groups. And it will reduce the sense of conflict, even if it never completely eliminates it.
Do you have any sense of the Philippine government being helped by other countries?
In the fight against Abu Sayyaf, for example, this is one of the first places the United States went after 9/11. And if you go down to Basilan, that was one of the key places where the United States was helping the Philippine government. We saw the U.S. helping the Philippine government when they were fighting in the Matate group in Marawi City. So the U.S. does help, and they are potentially getting help from some other places, at least in training and training and in some intelligence sharing with some of the countries around them.
Roger Baker, Senior Vice President of Strategic Analysis at the American Geopolitical Intelligence Platform, Stratfor. He was speaking with VOA Asia's Ira Melman. These are among some of the top Asia stories that you'll find right now when you visit voanews.com. Growing Chinese Navy adds risk to clashes in Asia's major maritime dispute. Prominent Chinese rights lawyer sentenced to 4.5 years in prison. China foreign investment law raises concern. No end in sight for radar dispute between Seoul and Tokyo. Singer in Thai girl band apologizes for swastika shirt. You'll find expanded coverage of all these stories and much more when you visit VOA Asia Facebook and also our website. That's voanews.com. VOA Asia continues. I'm Jim Stevenson in Washington. Beijing says it is investigating a Chinese-Australian writer for alleged involvement in criminal activities endangering national security. In Australia, a prominent government MP is demanding that author Yang Hengjun be freed immediately. From Sydney, Phil Mercer reports.
Yang Hengjun was arrested a week ago after arriving in China from the United States, where he's a visiting scholar at Columbia University. Officials in Beijing say the Australian national is being questioned on suspicion of espionage. He's being held in residential detention by Chinese state security. Previously, dissidents held in similar conditions have been interrogated around the clock. Rights groups allege the process involves torture, a claim denied by China. Australia Defence Minister Christopher Pyne arrived Thursday in Beijing for unrelated talks. Pyne said he would raise the case with his Chinese counterpart.
The Australian government is obviously concerned with the residential surveillance of Mr. Yang. He's an Australian citizen and we are seeking to provide him with consular assistance and support to ensure that he's treated fairly and transparently. And I'll be raising with General Wei that very requirement on behalf of the Australian government, that he be given access to consular support.
Australian diplomats were finally allowed to see the detained blogger and former diplomat a week after his arrest. In Australia, a government MP, Andrew Hastie, has made a scathing assessment of China's actions, insisting the detention of Mr. Yang was arbitrary, and he called for his immediate release. Analysts believe the arrest could be Beijing's way of warning the Chinese diaspora not to openly talk about politics. Yang Hengjun previously has been a critic of China's Communist Party, but not in recent times. For Australian officials, delicate diplomacy is needed. China is Australia's biggest trading partner. but observers believe Canberra must manage carefully what has been a fractious relationship with the Chinese. In December, Australia, for the first time, explicitly blamed China for cyber espionage and directly accused the Chinese state of approving a global campaign of the theft of trade secrets and confidential business information. Phil Mercer for VOA News, Sydney.
Happening now in Asia, China is moving quickly to push forward a draft version of its first foreign investment law this week. Among other things, the proposed law bans forced technology transfers, guarantees national treatment for foreign investors, and steps up intellectual property rights protections, all key issues in the trade dispute with Washington. Stay up to date with VOA. You're listening to VOA Asia. We're glad you're with us today on VOA Asia. Two new reports came out this month highlighting the threat of North Korea's nuclear weapons program. Meanwhile, the White House continues with plans to hold another summit between U.S. President Donald Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un. Experts warn this summit must produce more substance than the first. White House correspondent Patsy Whitaker-Sawara has more.
The threat of North Korea's nuclear weapons program is as real as ever. A new report by the Center of Strategic and International Studies points out Shino-ri, a nuclear facility 200 kilometers north of the demilitarized zone with South Korea and one of 20 missile bases undeclared by Pyongyang.
It shows that North Korea's ballistic missile program and its nuclear weapons program is a lot more complex and extensive than maybe the public knows about. And this report only supports or basically boosts the findings of the U.S. government's missile defense report that was released just last week.
On January 18th, the White House announced President Trump and North Korean leader Kim Jong-un will meet again next month.
Kim Jong-un is looking very forward to it, and so am I. We've made a lot of progress that has not been reported by the media.
But many experts are not convinced progress has been made since the two leaders met in Singapore last June.
We've got this, you know, optic of rapprochement. But it's not accompanied by substance. And so we really need to figure out a process that allows both of those to go together.
The first summit generated headlines but produced only broad statements towards achieving denuclearization. Experts say the second summit must yield at least a verifiable process towards denuclearization and tension reduction.
If we were in an ideal situation, the United States would be looking to get a list of all of North Korea's nuclear weapons testing sites, all of the places where they produce nuclear fissile material for the weapons, their ballistic missile production facilities, and the North Korean nuclear missile bases.
This would mean an intrusive inspections program, which Pyongyang refused to agree to, fearing it would make North Korea vulnerable to U.S. military strikes. Pyongyang also wants sanctions to be eased, something Washington is not willing to do. Critics say a second summit with little substance could be detrimental.
Well, if that happens, we're basically saying, well, it's okay, Kim Jong-un is going to be Kim Jong-un. He's going to be accepted as a nuclear weapons state leader before the rest of the world. Other countries are going to take that as a signal that it's okay to engage.
That means North Korea would be accepted as a nuclear power after it withdrew from the 1968 Non-Nuclear Proliferation Treaty in 2003. Experts are concerned other states might be tempted to pursue nuclear weapons too. According to North Korean media, Kim said he trusts Trump's, quote, positive way of thinking. The White House said the second summit is scheduled sometime in late February. Patsy Widakuswara, VOA News, at the White House.
Coming up, painting a brighter community. You're listening to VOA Asia.
For more on the stories you've heard on our radio programs, visit our website at voanews.com. That's where you'll find in-depth reports, related stories, videos, and more from our team of correspondents. Or take the news with you by downloading podcasts of your favorite VOA program. That's at voanews.com.
voanews.com.
Online news for a changing world.
is news from VOA Asia. The Trump administration announced criminal charges against one of China's largest telecommunications companies. Huawei, as a company, and its chief financial officer, Meng Wanzhou, were charged with money laundering, bank fraud, wire fraud, and conspiracy. Huawei was also charged with conspiracy to obstruct justice. Visit VOA Asia Facebook as this story develops. This is VOA Asia. As VOA Asia continues, in Taiwan, many villages are nearly forgotten. Young people have left for work in the cities, and local trades such as fishing have declined. But more than 90 of these villages got a makeover within the past decade. Artists have painted giant, colorful murals on the walls of old buildings or even the streets. Two villages are especially popular and attract tourist crowds. Ralph Jennings tells us rainbow-colored art, sharks, and even a poodle that licks people's hands have covered previously gray-walled homes.
This tourist is lying in a pool of sharks and rays. It's not a real pool, but a painting of one in Taiwan. He's lying there for a photographer, so it looks like he's swimming with the sea animals. At another village, visitors look for the best places to take photos with rainbow-themed murals. One woman risks getting slobbered on by a giant poodle. The rainbow-themed village started the trend. A 96-year-old man began painting the former military camp in central Taiwan as his hobby. His art grabbed enough attention to save a few houses from demolition and redevelopment.
I thought of what to draw myself. I didn't have any books to refer to. I didn't know people would like it so much.
At this isolated fishing village in southern Taiwan, most people are elderly and rely on harvesting oysters for a living. 3 years ago, Taiwan's central government hired an artist to paint images on the ground and the sides of buildings. The 19 images of marine life and storybook characters look 3D when seen in photos.
This here is a coastal area, so I used an ocean theme and a water theme for this creation. The key point, I think, is that to live, people need to hang on to their memories.
This rainbow village once had 1,200 houses. Most are gone, but the tireless painting of walls, floors, and even roofs saved a few of them. That's because city officials saw the importance of keeping them intact as a way to draw tourists, like Sherry Childs.
Like, has little sayings and, like, people where you can, or like paintings of little, like a boy and a girl holding hands. Like, it's just cute.
The three-dimensional marine murals draw enough sightseers to raise enthusiasm in the remote village of just 2,000 people. A lot of those people initially wondered why the village needed an artist. But now a coffee stand and several food vendors are making money off the crowds. The cafe operator describes his village's transformation since he moved back 3 years ago.
3 years ago, when teacher Singh first moved his brush, a lot of villagers didn't quite support him. But after the first three paintings and people started to come in bit by bit for sightseeing with a new way of thinking, and some of the villagers, the elders, would say, wow, that's interesting.
Sightseers simply enjoy the art for now. Many stop for a drink, spending money that was lured here by the tip of a brush. Ralph Jennings for VOA News from Halmei Village, Taiwan.
This news from VOA Asia. A popular Thai music act has apologized after one of its members wore a shirt showing the swastika flag of Nazi Germany during a performance. The incident involving the girl group BNK48 occurred just 2 days ahead of International Holocaust Remembrance Day on Sunday. All the big stories come your way through the day on VOA Asia Facebook. This is VOA Asia. Now on VOA Asia, there are all kinds of unusual private museums here in the United States, from the International Spy Museum to one showcasing hair. And with Americans' love affair with their dogs, well, it's not surprising there's also a dog museum. VOA's Deborah Block tells about it.
New Yorkers have a particular love of dogs, and so it seems appropriate that the American Kennel Club Museum of the Dog will be returning to New York City in February, after 30 years in St. Louis, Missouri. While there are not actual dogs in the museum, visitors can learn about the history of dogs and the various breeds in other ways. The AKC runs the country's oldest purebred dog registry.
Well, the Meet the Breeds table has a tremendous amount of content that we've acquired over the years with the AKC. It's been helped out by our AKC staff by putting in things about the dog's origins, their appearance, their temperament, their history, and the images that we have in this collection.
There are 150 pieces in the museum and a library with 15,000 books. You can even find out which breed you resemble. The collection has paintings of royalty and U.S. presidential pets, including dogs from both Bush administrations, George W. Bush's Scottish Terriers and George H.W. Bush's English Springer Spaniel, Millie. The museum also displays the skeleton of Belgrave Joe, a 19th century smooth fox terrier that was important to shaping the breed.
This is a skeleton that was of a very famous smooth fox terrier. He was so famous, he was really sort of the father of the breed.
The American Kennel Club has been criticized for promoting dog breeding as a beauty contest. But officials say there is value in breeding to refine canine traits, from human compatibility to bomb-sniffing working dogs.
I think the best thing to take away is the fact that you know, dogs were meant to have different jobs. Dogs all have their own jobs today, but they had different jobs and they've changed over the years. It's learning why they were purposely bred for certain jobs and their activities and their attributes and how they would function in society.
The Kennel Club hopes the new museum's location near New York's Grand Central Terminal will draw in more dog lovers. Deborah Block, VOA News.
Amazon's long search for a new headquarters location, which was nicknamed HQ2, came to an end back in November as the company decided to open offices in New York City and Crystal City in Northern Virginia. And while the opening of HQ2 is still months away, Natasha Moskovaya visited the original Amazon HQ in Seattle.
Unlike campuses of many tech giants that are often tucked away in city suburbs, Amazon's headquarters are located in the very heart of Seattle. But location is not the only thing that makes the campus unique. Three huge glass and steel biodomes create a very unusual work environment for the employees of the tech giant.
There's been a lot of scientific research that shows that when you are surrounded by green, surrounded by nature, your brain works a little bit differently. Maybe it thinks more creatively. So we're really excited to give our employees this opportunity to come in here to work in a place that feels a little bit different, that feels really refreshing, and also to educate them on all of the different types of plants that are here from all over the world.
There are over 40,000 plants from more than 50 countries inside the biodomes. Here, Amazon employees can sit in a cozy nest or conduct a staff meeting under a cocoa tree.
That takes a little bit of getting used to. But I think for me at least, I really enjoy that adds to the freedom and the creativity that you have. It's the first building that we've done where you don't have a desk. It's just kind of all free spaces. And, if you are an early bird, you can pretty much, pick where you want to work.
Even the company's more conventional office buildings have interesting cozy workspaces galore. Here, for instance, one can play chess or shuffleboard, or lock themselves in a phone booth to get some privacy during a phone conversation, while others might enjoy spaces like this amphitheater, where they can work and watch something fascinating on TV. And this stand offers free bananas. Those who distribute them are affectionately called banistas. But it's not just people who enjoy this unusual space. About 6,000 dogs also come to work in Amazon, or rather accompany their owners.
It's really nice, especially even a stress reliever. He just comes and, pet him. A lot of people will stop by my desk, not to see me, but to see JoJo.
Blake Ferry's dog, Gus, pretty much grew up in this building.
The first week when he was a puppy was a bit of a challenge just because he wanted to meet everyone. But once he settled down, no problems at all.
It is still unclear what the interior of Amazon offices will look like in Virginia and New York City. But local dogs are already panting in anticipation. For Natasha Moskovaya in Seattle, Washington, Anna Rice, VOA News.
You've been listening to VOA Asia. You'll find us online at iTunes and SoundCloud, great places to hear our program or even download it if you like. You can also check us out on VOA Asia Facebook each day. And our website is voanews.com. That's where you'll find all of our programs, current and past. You'll also hear us on the radio throughout Asia, including CCU Radio at National Chung Cheng University in Taipei, Taiwan. Thanks to everyone there today who's tuned in. Our thanks go to Director Tracy Carter, Engineer Aydin Utku, Managing Editor Diane Gao, and our VOA Asia team. That's Skylar Ogden, Ira Melman, Doug Bernard, Keith Lane, and Anna Cook. I'm Jim Stevenson. We're in Washington. We hope you have a wonderful day.